the title or the theme of the conference is the validity of language assessments in the context of migration and citizenship. Yeah. I would be interested if you could give me an example of how language assessment is being used in immigration and or in citizenship procedures.
Sure. Well, in a number of countries in Europe in the last few years, partly I think as a reflection of tensions within different countries associated with immigrant communities, countries have slowly been using language assessments at different stages of the immigration process. So obviously there's been a tradition in some countries for many years of requiring knowledge of the national language for citizenship, though that has increased so that more and more countries in Europe are doing that now. And then as well, language tests are being used at different stages, earlier stages. So for a long time, language tests have been associated with the registration of immigrant professionals, so for example, health professionals. They may need to be tested in the language that they're going to be working in, but also then even at earlier stages, so to get a residence visa, and more recently in the Netherlands and the United Kingdom, in order to be able to marry a citizen of the country concerned, before, if you are from, you know, if you're from abroad, you need to take a language test even before you leave your own country in order to get a visa.
And so if you're looking at the validity of these assessments, that implies that the validity is questionable. If there's a problem, what is the problem?
Well, I think that validity is a question that we need to ask about all language assessments. And to ask whether they are valid does not necessarily imply that they are not. I mean, as part of the professional development of language tests, we need to be sure that the conclusions that we're reaching about individuals have some sort of basis. I mean, it's very easy, as we know, to reach a conclusion about a person based on a limited amount of evidence that we learn later to be wrong. I mean, you know, you might offer somebody a job, or you might offer somebody a room in your house or flat, and then come to regret it later because the impression that you formed on the basis of the interview when you first spoke to them is an impression that then changed with subsequent evidence. So validation of tests involves a process for finding out more information about a sample of the candidates, for example, to see whether the conclusions that the test arrives at are borne out by other kinds of investigation and other kinds of evidence. So it's normal for serious tests, especially tests with where people's life chances are being decided, it's important that those tests be valid. I think with immigration and citizenship, I think that there's another issue as well. One of the aspects of validity is what are the values, what are the social and cultural values which are involved in the practice of the assessment. And I think that that's clearly the case with citizenship and with immigration. Sometimes there is a heated discussion in a country about the question of the presence of immigrant communities. And then as part of this discussion, there can be a resort to language testing on grounds that are sometimes not entirely clear. Sometimes the argument is put in terms of, well, people need to be able to speak the national language in order to do various things, you know, to get work and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's framed in terms of the interests of the immigrants, and sometimes that's perfectly correct. But at other times, what the discussion is doing is appealing to the middle ground of politics, to the middle ground of the majority culture, the majority language group, and so on. And then it's a kind of competition about who can appear to be the toughest on these immigrant communities. And we find in Europe that the level that is required for various levels of rights of residence or rights of citizenship varies according to the intensity of the political debate in the society around the question of immigration.
So when you have this political context,
mm-hmm.
Would you then conclude that it's not possible to test somebody fairly or objectively, that a personal You'll always be coloured by personal views.
No, you might be able to test them fairly and objectively, but you might say, well, what is the relevance of this? What is the real meaning of this testing practice? And what do we think about the meaning of that? It seems to me, for example, some people have studied this in the United States and in Luxembourg and in the Netherlands to a certain extent, that while the tests appear to be motivated, or not appear to be, I mean, the argument is sometimes put that the tests are good for the immigrants, that they're in the whole testing process is in the interest of the immigrants, it's pretty clear that really what is going on is a debate in society about the symbols of belonging and not belonging, and language is a very convenient symbol for that. So that what I think really all I'm saying is that we need to understand the meaning of tests in two ways. One is as practical instruments for making decisions about people, and these practical instruments can have a good, you know, can be of good quality or of poor quality, and obviously they need to be of as good quality as we can make them on the one hand, but on the other hand, the very use of the instruments at all needs to be considered and thought about. Here there is no correct answer, of course, because we're entering in the realm of values and policies and political discussions, but I think it's important to recognize that that's what's involved in the language test, that it's not just a technical instrument for making a decision about a person in a sort of scientific way, but that it's an expression of social and cultural and political values, and these will necessarily be contested.
I saw that the International Language Testing Association has a code of ethics,
yes,
for language testers.
Yes.
Would that have any usefulness?
Yes,
in this
does.
Context,
it does. It does. In some ways, it does. For example, it insists that if tests are to be used for significant decisions, they need to be of high quality, and people who are working in the development of such tests need to observe. I mean, conform to the professional practices of the profession of language testing. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, the codes talk about the ethics of language testing. This is a more complicated business. My view is that the International Language Testing Association code doesn't fully address the complexity of the question of the relationship of tests to policies, and it also ignores the fact that the policies that tests are intended to serve are not usually determined by the people creating the language test. They're created by political forces and policy making procedures that lie quite outside language testing. So this raises a somewhat of a dilemma for language testers if they came to the conclusion just by themselves that the test does not represent the values that they hold, and they would have to decide whether they would participate in the creation of the test or not, and that's covered. That certainly is covered within the code of ethics of the International Language Testing Association.
Mm-hmm. And if we look at a country or a society as a club that outsiders may want to join,
yes,
I mean, then you could say let's say the Swiss Justice Minister recently said that knowledge of a national language is not too much to ask. It's a condition for integration. Is this not a reasonable demand? If you want to come and live among us, this is what we ask of you.
Well, I think that there's a difference between entry to a society and participation at the highest level through citizenship. I mean, studies in immigrant countries have shown that citizenship, effective and successful citizenship, does not necessarily depend only on language or even primarily on language. There have been interesting studies in Israel, for example, which has very, very large numbers of immigrants and enormous plurilingualism because of immigration. And people can participate effectively as citizens in that country without a very good knowledge of Hebrew, which is the national language. I think it's a society, Israel is a society with a very strong history of immigration on large scale. And in such a context, people are realistic about and perhaps more flexible about what it means to be able to participate. I think in more traditional societies, a more traditional view prevails, and that's certainly the case in many European countries, which are kind of struggling with their identity as immigrant societies. I mean, in many ways, of course, I think it's perfectly reasonable, the argument about competence in the main language of the society is a reasonable argument, especially for citizenship. But for other kinds of participation in society, we know that people can participate very successfully, and yet their competence in the national language is rather poor. I mean, we had a good example in Australia a couple of years ago when our government introduced language tests for citizenship for the first time. And one of the opponents of this was a member of the government. I mean, so it was a Conservative Party that brought in this policy. And one of the leading members of this party, I mean, he was a very well-known member who was of Greek ethnic background. His parents were Greek immigrants who'd moved to Australia in the 1960s. And they were Australian citizens because they had not had to pass the language test under the previous arrangements. He said, you know, my parents have been excellent citizens, and here am I, their son. I'm a member of parliament and a respected member of society. He said, my father always thought that he could speak English, but actually he couldn't. His English was terrible. And if he had been required to take a language test, he wouldn't have become a citizen. And he said, you know, in his view, this was unnecessary. It was making an issue out of something that wasn't really so much of an issue in the actual practical lives of immigrants. And I think in general we need to study carefully what it is that people need to do in order to be effective citizens and to participate constructively in the society that they're living in.
I'm just wondering if you have any particular comment to make on the Swiss situation.
Well, not really. I mean, I think as far as I understand, what's happening in Switzerland is that Switzerland is reflecting the general trends that are happening in societies around Europe and in my own society in Australia as well. We've followed various European examples. I mean, I think that what I would say to my own society, I mean, I hesitate to comment on Swiss society. I'm not a member of it, but I would perhaps encourage people to think about, well, what do we know about the way in which people successfully participate within a community? For example, we might ask about that Pakistani family. Was there evidence from neighbours, from workmates, from the school and so on, that this was a family with which was participating in the life of the general community in a constructive way, even with rather limited knowledge of the language of the canton? I think also there's an interesting issue in Switzerland about the varieties of, for example, of German and the different functions in society. Which variety of German would it be appropriate to insist on as part of a language requirement? You know, what are the expectations of speakers of various varieties about immigrants speaking their variety or speaking Hochdeutsch and so on? I think it's quite a complex issue. But I think it's very easy, I think, for policymakers to kind of reach for the gun of the language test. And even though I agree that there is a strong argument for including language in as a criterion for readiness and to participate, I think that what it means to be a good citizen is a much more complex matter than that. And we have to remember, of course, that in the case of the United Kingdom, the terrible terrorist bombings of the 7th of July a few years ago, which were carried out by British citizens who were born in Britain, who were native speakers of English. And so their refusal to participate in British society and the values of British society in the most violent terms was completely unconnected with their knowledge of the English language.
Just one final thing I wanted to ask you about, because I hadn't really heard of it before. How is language testing being used to establish the identity of asylum seekers who may not have papers? Are they kind of narrowing down by your accent what region you come from?
Well, I think that under the refugee law is a very important law. It guarantees, it was adopted after the Second World War in light of the terrible experience of Jewish refugees in the 30s who were often not given asylum and then met a very terrible fate. So in the aftermath of the Second World War, the Refugee Convention was adopted internationally, which gives rights of protection and refuge to people who are in danger of violence and persecution in their own societies. So it's a rather narrow law in the sense that you need to fall into that category to get protection. Some people who don't fall narrowly into that category may try to present themselves as falling into it by, for example, saying that they come from a war-torn country when in fact they may come from a neighbouring country. Mm-hmm. So the point of the language analysis is to see whether the language behaviour of the person corresponds with their story or not. Now, this is actually a very complicated business and it requires very complex sociolinguistic analysis to do it. Most countries don't take the trouble to do it carefully and I think do it very irresponsibly with quite dangerous outcomes. Fortunately, Switzerland, I think, is quite unique and exemplary in this regard, that they have resources within the Bureau for Migration which deal with this in a very systematic way, and other countries are actually learning from their methods.